Hello, it's me, Sam Dunnewald. I'm here before the show to tell you that I am kickstarting my first standalone in-print RPG, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's a John Wick-inspired game of bloody revenge inside a tight-knit clique of professional assassins. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder, and it's the end result of 3 years of interviews and ideation on all things game design right here on Dice Exploder. If you like the show, if you like how I think about game design, I think you're really going to love this game. I really just want you to know about it. I want you to play it. And you can follow the Kickstarter page right now at a link in the show notes. You can back the game starting May 5th. That's it. Thanks so much for listening, as always. I hope you check out the game. Here's Dice Exploder. Hello and welcome to a brand new season of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and tear it in half like a phone book. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Audrey Stoles, aka Lady Tabletop. I've wanted to have Audrey on for a standard format episode ever since she joined me back in the 2023 year-end bonanza. She's a smart voice on Tumblr, she makes cool games with great collage art, she's helped run all the game jams we've hosted on the Dice Exploder Discord, and she's got a great solo games actual play podcast, Alone at the Table, where you can hear her playing all kinds of solo games, including this week's game, Wreck This Deck by Becky Anison, a game in which you, the player, have learned how to trap demons in a deck of playing cards by mutilating the cards in various intriguing ways. Drawing on them, cutting them up, covering them in honey, burying them in a river, and waiting 3 weeks before you go back to pick them up. All kinds of nonsense. And we are specifically talking about the vengeance demon Flauros, who you trap by slicing up the three of diamonds into a triangular shape. It's all so tactile. It feels wrong to play this game, like transgressive, to destroy these perfect cards. And that feeling and its connection to the physicality of this act is the thing that this conversation is really about. There's something about a game that you have to play in person that leaves a physical artifact of play that can reach into a part of your body that I think an online game just can't do. And Wreck This Deck, I think, is a great one to talk about that feeling because it cuts to it so quickly. And because it's a solo game, so you don't need to put a whole group together to go explore that feeling yourself. You can go do that right now and then come back and listen. I'm actually so interested in physicality and this idea that next week we're going to have a second episode all about the flip side. Instead of destruction, that one is about creation. So if you want to do some homework and get ahead of the game on that one, check out Two Hand Path by Mikey Ham, and I'll see you next week. But this week, here is Audrey Stoles with the demon Flauros. Audrey, thanks for coming on Dice Exploder.
Excited to be here. It's going to be great.
Yeah. What are we talking about today?
We are talking about Wreck This Deck by Becky Anison, specifically the demon summoning / trapping mechanic, even more specifically, trapping the demon Flauros.
Love Flauros, my boy.
He is my favorite possibly in the text just because a lot of the cards in this game.
I gotta tell you, you gotta back way the heck up. So you love Flauros, I understand.
Yes.
But tell me, what the heck is Wreck This Deck?
So Wreck This Deck is a game that asks you to do exactly what the title says, which is to destroy, modify, add to, change, bleed on, bury, whatever else, a deck of cards. Standard 52-card poker deck, although you could play with pretty much any deck you wanted. This game is, as I said, by Becky Anison. It came into being over the pandemic, and it was one of those things that kind of took off online, like while it was first being playtested, mostly because it was something everybody could do by themselves in their home that was like visceral and felt really, really artistic, I think, in a way that a lot of people were looking for. Like some people get really into baking bread during the pandemic. Some people got really into doing like art stuff.
Some people got into wrecking their decks.
Exactly.
I think what you are saying is 100% true. This feels like a pandemic game, but not just the sort of solo experience of it, but the voice of the text is so inviting of community. It is saying to you, I'm a person in this world where you can trap demons in playing cards, And I'm here to tell you what I've learned by experimenting around with the form and to tell you that there's a whole internet's worth of people out there that are trying out the same things and getting killed in the process. So be careful, kids. And I've never read a game that has such a useful and great voice to the way it's written.
It really projects you into the situation immediately. And I think that there's a lot of, at least to me reading it, feels a lot of like back in the like early to mid 2000s when you had stuff like Marble Hornets and Creepypastas and like ARGs really taking off. The voice of this game is similar to that, and it invites you to be part of it. And that's something that's really compelling to me, because it's still functional as a game by itself, but the voice is never deviated from.
Yeah. And the voice like establishes the ground rules tone of what that online community that grew up around the game was going to become. And I think the fact that we were in lockdown was a huge part of why the game took off to the extent that it did. That community was wonderful. You could play the game at home, but you could also sit on Discord and do the thing. But I suspect it would have gotten some amount of that community anyway, just on the strength of the voice and the fact that the voice of the text is sort of summoning that community into existence in the first place.
Yeah, I like the way that you phrase that, like summoning the community, because it is telling you, hey, here's all this stuff about the world, and it's not necessarily good. And that's really resonant, I think, for a lot of people, especially over the last, you know, 8-10 years. And so it's saying we can do something about this. And even though that premise is fictional, that is an invitation that I think a lot of people wanted and still want. And so there is something really cathartic about playing this game, even as just a fiction, as a way to help process the things that are going on in the real world that are probably out of our control.
Yeah. And then the game empowers you to have a little bit of control over that world, right? Like it's giving you a set of tools to maybe enact your will onto at least the fictional world. And then, you know, build up legitimate community. It's cool stuff. Other sources of inspiration. There's an interview on the Yes Indeed podcast with former Dice Exploder co-host Thomas Manuel interviewing Becky about this game. I pulled a lot of stuff from that. People should go listen to that episode in the show notes if this game sounds cool to you. But Wreck This Journal is this book from like 2007. Yeah, there you go. By Carrie Smith. Which was this journal. I remember seeing this thing at the time where you buy this thing and would instruct you on ways that you should wreck this thing. You know, you're like sending it to yourself in the mail and you're setting it on fire and you're folding it in half, like, and like all this.
200 pages of different ways to destroy, maim, or otherwise impact this journal in a way that couldn't be undone.
Yeah. So what if that was a story game? And then Becky also talks about this moment of playing Pandemic Legacy. And I see two influences from Pandemic Legacy on this. The first is just the obvious of you are permanently disfiguring cards and then they become revised fictional components like in the game. And that's just how legacy board games work. But the other was specifically a moment she talks about the person that she's playing with being so unwilling to like rip up a card even when the game told them to. And that I resonate with that. I think most people resonate with that, either in a way of like gleeful, I get to rip up the cards, or in a like, oh no, like the thing is perfect, I don't want to like ruin the perfect thing.
Right. Like, it's like a beautiful, professionally illustrated, like coded solid card that when you tear apart, like there's no putting it back together. You know,
and that feeling is really what we're going to get into today. But before we do that, let's get into the specific mechanic of summoning demons and our demon friend Flaros.
Yes. So summoning demons, there is a big chart in the book that basically tells you what card the demon corresponds to so that you know which card you are modifying or destroying or whatever. And then it'll tell you what you need to do in order to summon the demon to that card and bind it, right? And so Flaros specifically is associated with the three of diamonds. It asks you to take the three of spades, clubs, and hearts, so the other three suits, arrange them with their corners touching until they make a triangular space in the middle. And then you place the three of diamonds on top of it, command Flauros to enter, and then cut the card into that triangular shape and burn each of its three edges. So I picked this mechanic specifically because to me, it's one of the more severe modifications that this game asks you to do. And it makes a shape that doesn't easily shuffle and is so obtrusive in your deck. It's so good. I love it so much.
Hate it. Hate it. I love shuffling cards. A magician once told me I was good at shuffling cards, and I'll ride that compliment to my grave. And I, at the Magic Castle, even, it was incredible.
Oh, that's great.
But like, he's just always there, like poking you while you're shuffling your deck. It's so flavorful.
And it's really ominous, too, where like you'll see the corner poking up and you're like, oh, man, I only got so many draws before Flauros is my card.
You come in. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing we should say about trapping demons before we kind of move on is this is the thing you're supposed to do to trap Flauros. But the game really presents this as like, this is what's worked for me. I don't know exactly. Like, make it up yourself. And other people are finding other demons. Like, make up your own with their own abilities. Like, go online and see what demons other people are trapping and do those things. It is taking the entire act of, like, building a hacking community and turning it into an in-fiction resource that you can go ascribe to.
Yeah, yeah. It's not just people sharing their cards and sharing like a narrative online. It's people saying, oh, well, what if I made a guide of yokai and I put that online for people to use? What if I made a guide of angels or Greek mythological figures? Or if you're me, an eldritch horror type thing, you know? And people are putting those out there. So there's all these other options if you wanted to do something else with your three of diamonds. And the game is also pretty explicit with like, hey, if you fuck up your demon summoning, I don't necessarily know what goes wrong. Like, you get to decide how this goes wrong, right? Like, I ended up burning my Flauros card down pretty severely, which was more of a actual fire problem than a in fiction problem. But, you know, it's supposed to be kind of a certain size because of the triangle of the cards. And that's not what I ended up with. And I'm sure that's different than what other people have done as well.
Yeah. So Flauros, who's this demon to you? What's their deal? What's the Duke of Hell up to these days? And how did he present himself to you?
So in the fiction of my game, I called on Flauros after basically like two or three botched summonings or summonings that then didn't pan out in the way I wanted in terms of how I was like using demon power. I recorded my playthrough on my podcast, by the way. So this is something people can listen to, which is very fun. But I ended up summoning him to like truly try to destroy, I think it was just some rich dude that was like stripping funding from this like local library program and trying to ban all these books and stuff. And so specifically summoned Flauros to deal with that guy. And he did. And all I got was some like newspaper headlines. Don't really know what happened. But yeah, now Flauros is here. And the whole thing with like summoning the demons is that it tells you this is what this demon needs. And if you aren't helping them like satiate that need, then they're going to wreak further havoc on you in any way they can. And so his need is like to take revenge and you're expected to aid in exchange for more power. And that hasn't really manifested in my game yet, but I know that it's going to because it's too juicy of a hook for me to leave laying there.
Yeah, I didn't sit down to really start playing this game until I learned from you what mechanic exactly we were going to talk about. And I was like, oh, we're doing Flauros. Great. Like, this is going to be the first demon I add to my deck. I'm going to just be John Wick. Like, that's the thing that we're going to do here. But I did this thing. Yeah, I was thinking about The Ink That Bleeds, which you can hear me talk about on 2023's year-end bonanza episode that we did together. And it has this idea of like taking solo games and blending the fiction of those games together. And so I took a lot of details from a couple other solo game sources I was playing at the time or had played in the past and like put them together, decided I was heading home because my magic mentor had been murdered and I was going to like murder everyone responsible. And then just started like murdering motherfuckers right and left as I got home with Flauros. And I think that was a really fun way to get some direction into my game right away. Like, I actually think this game would have been hard for me to start if I had not had you pick a demon for me to start with. And, you know, I guess anyone's going to read this thing and be drawn to one demon or another, but it definitely felt like picking a demon and kicking things off that way was a great way to kick things off, a little direction that the game maybe wasn't otherwise giving me.
Yeah. I think that there is one of the things that I love and also think is maybe a little bit detrimental to the game is how much the voice is like, you can just make this your own.
Yeah.
Because that's a great permission to have in the text and really sticks to the fiction that this game is setting up. But it also means that there's kind of like a looseness around anything in terms of starting and anything in terms of like ending like a storyline or like a quest that you set upon yourself or anything like that. It definitely expects you to fill in some blanks and to like make choices in a way that are not guided. And so for me, starting it, like part of what helped is that I was playing it for my podcast. And so I just dispensed with journaling altogether. I literally was just recording voice memos to myself on my phone as I was doing stuff with the cards. And that for me worked way better because it was like, I'm just going to stream of consciousness. Like, what makes sense? What am I reacting to? I decided on like what my problem was that I was initially trying to set out to tackle. And I had summoned, a few demons and even like made one up before I came to Flauros, because I definitely took a tact with mine that was more like subterfuge.
Yeah, I think I see this problem in just so many games. Like, this is a problem I have with like Dungeons and Dragons, is like this game doesn't function unless you go find or create for yourself a starting point. And I'm a writer by day. I don't want to like come home and have to like come up with a whole ass idea on my own to get my story started. Like, seeing where the story goes, I can handle that. Like, that's fun. The like moves snowball they talk about in Apocalypse World. I love doing that thing, and that's fun, bouncing from one part of the game to another part of the game. But like starting that snowball down the hill, it's just so much creative work. It's that like classic blue sky problem, and I just see so many games struggle with that. Like, even Apocalypse World I think struggles with that, and I wish that this game and other games like it had better tools for doing that.
And I think that sometimes that tool is just a random table, right? Like, we see a lot of random tables and stuff, but I totally get it. Like, the creative lift of saying, this is like my onset, or this is the instigating factor here, is a lot more than reacting to whatever the onset is. And it's part of why in GM'd games, like back when I was mostly playing Dungeons and Dragons and Pathfinder, I preferred to be a player, because reacting was so much easier and more fun than having to come up with all of the scenarios and keep track of all of that. And so in solo games too, I love to play them, but whenever the creative lift is too much, I just set it back down, right? Yeah. Or I say, you know, I'm not going to remember what I did the last time I played this a month ago. Like, I'm just going to kind of pick up where I left off as best I remember, and I'm not going to sweat it, you know, because who's judging my playthrough of a solo game?
Well, you're recording yourself as a podcast and putting it out there, so people might be judging it, but for those playing at home, like, yeah, who cares? I think that advice is really, and also like for your podcast, who cares? Like, you know, that's actual play for you, but that's the difference.
I mean, and the other thing on like tangentially on my podcast is there have been times before where I'll just like straight up not do what the game is telling me to do, or I'll change something. And then at the end, when I'm like debriefing, I'm like, hey guys, you might have noticed I changed this thing. It's more fun for me that way. Like,
that's a really nice thing about solo games at large, is it's so much easier to do that with them.
I think so. Although I do think that that maybe brings us nicely around to kind of why we're talking about this mechanic, because there's a lot of people that I have played with and people that I know who feel that if the rules are not explicitly giving you permission, then you're transgressing in some way. And so that's not necessarily what we're here to talk about, because I think that's silly and the rules are just words on a piece of paper and you can do what you want because you're a living, breathing person. But
yeah,
tearing up a car.
Well, I think that breaking rules is transgressing.
Like, I think if we're sitting down to play Dungeons and Dragons and we decide that we're going to roll D12s instead of D20s, like, that is transgressing. But, absolutely. Like, transgressing is fun, right? Like, and that's the thesis, I think, of Wreck This Deck. Like, that's truly the origin story of this game, is Becky being like, transgressing is fun. Please come do it. Like, just get started fucking up your deck of cards and, like, seeing how that goes. I have this deck of cards over here right now sitting on my desk for weeks. It's just like covered in a little thin layer of honey. And I hate that shit. That's so bad. It's so, I hate touching it. Everything about it sucks. But it's just like here, that's, it's cool. And like, it's so charged and memorable to me because I engaged with this game and engaged with that transgression of taking this beloved old deck of cards that I've played hundreds of hours of bridge with, and also written on for a playthrough of Void 1680, and like started Wreckegg. Like that whole thing is just cool.
This game gives you a tactile artifact of play that is, to me at least, incomparable to the artifacts of play generated by most other games that are intended to do that. Like, this one is just, it's a mess. You're going to have a mess at the end, and it's awesome. I love it. I'm like, you know, and then I'm like walking past my craft desk with the King of Hearts with push pins through his eyes and mouth and stuff. And I'm like, oh yeah, what was I doing with him? Like, you know, like found a Jack of Spades on the sidewalk. I was like, I'm just going to add this to my deck. Just seems fun. Now I have two Jacks of Spades in there.
Yeah. Like, and one of them's got the wrong back and like, what
exactly,
does that mean?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's such a call to action, not just like this is a fun thing to do here, but like, hey, maybe you can do this with any game. Maybe you can do this in real life. Like, I really feel like this game is trying to say, like, you don't have to get married. Why would you have to get married if you don't want to get married? Just go live the life that you want to live. Like, transgress, do the fun thing out there. You know, here's a small scale like place to practice.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, if you can't rip up a card when you like hex someone, or you can't stand to paint over a card with like gold ink or something and just to mess up this card in an irreparable way, then how can you stand to possibly ever challenge any sort of authority or do any sort of thing outside of the social norms? And I think it's especially significant to me with Wreck This Deck because the tactility of it makes the transgression feel so, so satisfying because you have a physical result for the thing that you just did. And there's games that play with tactile space, but there's not a ton of games that play with, like, don't be precious about your art and don't be precious about the things that you own because they are things, you know?
It feels visceral. Is how I would say it. Yeah.
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go, see for yourself, 3 floors up, gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amoretta speaking. Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbians noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
This episode of Dice Exploder is sponsored by Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. And these minis come in a variety of materials, including bronze, color standees, and color plastic options. Or download model files for your minis and 3D print their unique designs right in your own home. Hero Forge also has custom printed dice where they'll stick your favorite mini floating inside a die, or put that mini on a keychain. Hero Forge custom acrylic keychains are printed at the same scale as the rest of Hero Forge minis and arrive already attached to a high quality zinc alloy lobster clasp, so you can take your favorite character wherever you go. Hero Forge is constantly expanding its catalog of customization options, adding new parts every week, so check back in and see what you've missed. Visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom miniature and dice today. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Die Meta Dungeon. Die Meta Dungeon is a campaign-length, dungeon-based adventure for the Die RPG that is also a crawl through 60 years of tabletop RPG history. In Die Meta Dungeon, your characters will enter a massive dungeon that grows deeper and more dangerous as more people succumb to the honeyed allure of role-playing games. Dungeon crawl your way through every era of gaming, from the 1970s to the present day, one decade per dungeon level. Survive to the end, and you might learn something. For the first time in the Die RPG, player characters will get to return to the real world between levels of the dungeon, trying to juggle their real-life problems, and maybe even apply some of the important things they've learned about themselves in the dungeon, before being drawn inexorably back into the meta dungeon. It's a classic fantasy mega dungeon campaign with a postmodern twist, and at least 6 months of sessions baked into it. Die Meta Dungeon is on BackerKit through April 2026. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Orbital Blues Month. 1 month, 6 creators, an entire outlaw galaxy to explore. Orbital Blues is an RPG of sad space cowboys where your crew of desperate and downtrodden outlaws travel across a music-infused space western universe filled with retro-future technology plagued by heartbreak and the haunting shadow of the blues. And through the end of April on BackerKit, 6 creators are all running projects that expand the Orbital Blues universe. Check out Outlaws and Corporations from Soul Muppet Publishing, a book filled with NPCs, adventures, and setting inspiration. Formula Infinity from Plus One EXP, a high-octane space racing adventure complete with bespoke mechanics for racing. Or A Fistful of Stars from Stations, an interwoven series of adventures set on an interstellar train line. Or any 3 other projects. Each project also comes with a soundtrack from Behold, which you're listening to part of right now, and which you can get as a limited edition cassette tape when you back multiple projects. Orbital Blues Month through the end of April on BackerKit. Check it out.
So we're talking about physicality and tactility and transgression and how each of those things kind of amplifies the others. But I feel like there's kind of 2 feelings at play here. There's the thing we were kind of talking about of in some way like challenging authority with it. And on the other side is the feeling of, I don't want to ruin something beautiful. So I have a lot to say about this, but I'm going to start here. I want to start with Tim Hutchings and his game, Thousand-Year-Old Vampire. So
excellent.
It is a game in which you play as a thousand-year-old vampire who's sort of slowly like losing your memories as you go through the centuries. And it comes in this book where Tim would like you to write in this beautiful, beautiful book and like write your playthrough in there and like really mess up this book. And I've never heard of anyone actually doing that because the book is so pretty. And there's another game of his, a collection of improving exercises, which is sort of a similar thing. It's styled as a learn how to do perspective drawing manual from the 1920s, but in practice, it sort of devolves into chaos, and it's this like meditation on breaking the rules and taking, again, this gorgeous, gorgeous book and drawing your ugly ass little scribbles all over it. And I think people have a really hard time playing those games in the way that they're intended to be played because the objects are so beautiful. And I've talked to people who are like, I don't want to play a collection of improving exercises because I don't want to ruin the thing. And I think Tim is out here saying that's the point. Like that feeling of transgression that you and I have been talking about, it's actually better and more beautiful and more powerful and even more of a fuck you to authority when you are destroying something beautiful. And actually the object becomes more beautiful when you bring yourself to it.
I agree completely. And I think that Tim Hutchings has a lot to say about art that he doesn't always explicitly say. And
yeah,
you've hit the nail on the head. Like, part of the point is that people who don't want to write in thousand-year-old vampire probably also don't want to stick their stickers on anything.
Yeah.
And it's meant to be used and it's meant to be enjoyed. And that doesn't mean that it has to be preserved forever.
Yeah.
And so if you're not going to write in your copy of thousand-year-old vampire, fine. Your choice. That's how you're going to play the game. It can sit on your shelf and it can be beautiful. But I don't know. I like going to the thrift store and picking up a book and finding out that someone made annotations in the sidebars. You know, I think that that's wonderful and it adds to the experience.
You've made a new friend.
Yeah. Like, I'm never going to talk to this person, but I'm getting to see what their experience of it was. And so even if in the case of like thousand-year-old vampire or improving exercises, the person that you are getting to have a relationship with is your past self that played this game already. I still think that's worthwhile. And I still think that that doesn't mean you can't play it again or read it again or appreciate it again or keep it on your shelf, you know?
Yeah. I think about one of my favorite books is Thief of Time, a Discworld book by Terry Pratchett.
Yes, love it.
I read it in 6th, 7th, 8th grade, something like that. Back then I ran like a Discworld books like lending library out of my locker at school. And like I would just read these books. Every month my family would like go to Barnes and Noble. I'd pick up 3 more Discworld books, like shotgun them all down as quickly as I could, and then loan them out to all my friends. And my copy of Thief of Time is just beat to absolute shit. It's like falling apart. The cover hasn't quite fallen off, but it's close.
The
color is all fading. It might as well have been dropped in the bathtub. Maybe it was by one of my friends. Who knows? And one year for Christmas, my sister, my wonderful, lovely sister, who I love very much, got me a signed first edition copy of Thief of Time. And I looked at it and I was like, what the fuck am I going to do with this? Like what value
does this
have to me?
It's just going to take up shelf space.
Who cares? Like, and I do actually, I do love that. I do love having that signed first edition too. It is beautiful and I'm never going to read it. I'm just going to have it there as sort of like a totem on my shelf. But when I read a passage from Thief of Time at my wedding, which of these books do you think I read from, right? Like the thing that has more value to me is the one that I know like touched each of my friends' hands coming out of that lending library.
I think that that's a great comparison. I definitely have like my copy of Fellowship of the Ring is falling apart and doesn't have its title anymore because I had like an acetate jacket that I pulled off and like, you know, so it's a testament to the things that you've enjoyed and you've loved to show the wear on them and the ways that you have explicitly touched them. And I just think that there is something about making memories that is so much easier and that like sticks in your brain more if there is a physicality to it. Mm-hmm. And if there is like, I'm not going to go back and read my journal entries that I've written in random journals from past games, unless I play a game that wants me to write in the margins, which I might. But like, if I'm writing in the book for thousand-year-old vampire and I'm telling a friend about it and I'm saying, hey, like my playthrough's in here, like you can totally check that out, you know, that to me is more memorable. And Wreck This Deck is doing that too. Like a deck of playing cards is intricately designed. There's a reason that playing cards have been around for so long and that like the design of them has been so consistent. Like Becky's asking you to destroy something beautiful as well.
Yeah.
It just feels less transgressive with a deck of cards because you can pick one up for $1 at the gas station, you know?
Yeah. I want to touch on that exactly, like, because I heard this argument. We were talking about this episode a little in the Discord in the past week. And someone was saying, I'm so much more excited to play Wreck This deck than Thousand-Year-Old Vampire in the like way they are written to be played, because Wreck This deck, as you say, I can pick up for a dollar at the airport. And I was like, you don't understand how beautiful a deck of cards is. Like, how dare you destroy a deck of cards? Like, all the potential in that. Like, I'm truly still mourning the fact that I took this deck of cards that I have played so many hands of bridge with my friends, and ruined it by marring it for Void 1680 initially. And I regret that. Like, I wish I still had the, like, perfect artifact of play that was like my communal thing. Like, I feel like I betrayed my friends, you know, by like hoarding this deck for myself in a way. But like, that's just another, nothing lasts forever, you know, like everything
right.
ends. And I think practicing that by destroying a beautiful deck of playing cards, whether it's brand new or old, or doing whatever kind of transgression, I just think that that's such a healthy and fun thing to do.
I think for me, because I was like, I have been very briefly in my life the person that didn't want to put like stickers on anything. Mm-hmm. But like, part of it for me is that when you were a kid, at least for my childhood, like, I had sticker books. I'm using my stickers liberally as they're given to me. I'm putting them on my folders for school. I'm putting them all over my bedroom door, and my parents are getting mad about it. Like, I found literally at my parents' house the last time I went there, a deck of cards that I had defaced as a kid. That was just like one that we used that was like all the cast offs, or like a deck that was missing a queen or something that mom was like, you can do whatever you want. And we just like wrote all over it, yeah. You know? And I know that that's like, that's just my experience, and that's not going to be the experience that everyone has had. But I think that as kids, we have less hangups necessarily about making our mark on something, right? Like, that's for your parents to freak out about when you draw on the wall, or that's for your parents to get mad about if you tear the page out of a picture book or something, right? And to some degree, like, there's a healthy amount of like, you don't want to just destroy things, and you work hard for things and you pay for things and whatever. But also, I think that there is a nice healthy dose of going back to remembering that like, they are just things. No matter what memories are attached, no matter what you spent on them, no matter how they look, they are just things.
I think as a kid, you also don't have a sense of time in the same yes. way. That it's just sort of like, you know what would be cool right now? If this picture book page got ripped right out of there, that'd be fun. Oh, the sound that it makes, like, that's really satisfying. I'm going to do that. And I think that, like, coming to realization that actions have consequences
yes.
is an act of growing up. And I think the step past that, that I think you and I are both so excited about here with this game, and the like lesson is like, yeah, but like, sometimes it's worth it to pay those consequences. This is actually like a pretty personal thing, but I think a lot about having Crohn's disease and not being able to eat. I love chocolate donuts. Like, back in the day, that was in high school, I eat so many chocolate donuts. And it got to a point where I realized like, these were really bad for my Crohn's disease and I should not eat them anymore. And like, I don't now, but also sometimes I do, because they're delicious. And it's definitely bad for me. And I immediately, like, am in pain. And, like, you know, it's the same thing of, like, friends who have lactose intolerance and they're just like, I'm going to pop a lactate and have a pizza. You know, like, sometimes we do the thing. And but I think that attitude of, like, you know, sometimes it's worth it, though. Sometimes it's worth paying the consequences, or sometimes the consequences aren't as real as you think they are. You know, it's like,
that's the flip side of the coin, right? Is like, sometimes how much of the consequence is just in your head? You know,
yeah,
how much
yeah,
of the consequence is just a thing that you think is like an expectation, but it's not.
Yeah, big, like, don't pull people over for going 75 on the highway. You know, speed limits are like an illusion. Laws at large, kind of an illusion. We just kind of like, you know, punish the people that we're racist against and otherwise don't like, you know?
Or if you get caught, you know?
Yeah, or if you get caught, right? Like, I'm making a golden cover game right now in which you're supposed to play it while streaking through my hometown. So,
oh my God, amazing. One. I'm never going to be in your hometown, but I would play that game if I was there.
Yeah, great, great. It's just all fun. I don't know. It's fun to play. It's fun to be a little cheeky.
Yeah, I think that there is this dopamine hit or like adrenaline rush of being like, oh, I just did that,
yeah.
You know, and like feeling like, you know, you were not supposed to do that, or that, you know, that normally you wouldn't do that, which to me is the thing that happens in the fiction of Wreck This Deck, is like you are immersed in the fiction and doing it. But like as you stop playing, you're like, oh, normally I would not do that.
Yeah.
Like that is not normally how I would treat a deck of cards. I also think that like if you're someone like us, like you played a lot of Bridge, I played a lot of Pinnacle and other games with my family growing up. So like I have a very long-standing relationship with cards and card games and how you treat cards and how you shuffle cards and what you do not do to cards. And like it feels extra good to play this game because of that, to be like, yeah. You know what, Grandma? I'm gonna rub my greasy chip fingers all over these cards. Like, yeah. Who cares?
Yeah. There are a few other examples I know you were interested in getting to.
Yes. I feel like I have to talk about my favorite solo LARP, which is Birds Love Dirt by Emily Jankowski. It's a game where you're a bird, you love dirt, go outside and dig in the dirt. Anytime you find yourself thinking about something else, remind yourself that you're a bird and you love dirt. And like, that's the whole game. But that one to me feels transgressive because, again, part of the like whole growing up thing is like, cleanliness and like who has time to just go dig in the dirt, just go poke a stick or a rock or whatever in the dirt. And also sometimes like who has access to a patch of dirt that they can just dig in and play in and things like that. And so that one to me is one that feels really good, because especially when I'm like overworking myself or I'm burning out or whatever, like I should just go in my garden for just a little bit and just like put my fingers in the dirt. It is the literal definition of like touching grass.
Yeah.
But I think that that's like the permission to check out and the permission to think about nothing that that game is asking you to do feels transgressive in a similar way to me, because it's things that like, not that we like forget we can do, but that maybe we don't think of, the same way that like, you know, destroying something or just painting all over something or just doing bad art is like not always something we think of, that like you can just do that, you know?
Yeah. God, that really feels like the Wreck This Deck ethos too, of you can do a bad job and it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, if you think you did a really bad job, then like say what went wrong, I guess. But like, it's on you. Just go forth and have fun. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Wreck This Deck is very much the vein of like, you can't do it wrong. Like, just do it.
Yeah. Okay. And you've got one last example in here too.
Yeah. So Under the Autumn Strangely is the last one I wanted to touch on. It's by Graham Gentz. It's pastoral horror, GM-less, group play. The mechanic in this one is like tactile in the barest sense of the word, in that you are expected to be passing little trinkets to one another. And the game is pretty explicit in that like you don't need to be using uniform tokens. These trinkets can be anything. It wants you to be like, oh yeah, I have this acorn or I have this shell and I'm just going to do that, right? And so first of all, just in like unconventional materials, that one feels a little bit transgressive, where it's like, oh, maybe I just had this thing that I like collected and that's been sitting on a shelf, but I'm going to use it as a trinket in this game. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it is that those tokens that you are then supposed to use are explicitly just called change, and they are only used to say, no, actually, that doesn't happen, which I think is a thing that doesn't necessarily get encouraged in games a lot, especially GM-less games.
Yeah.
But it is explicitly like there are three roles in the game and each role can only contradict one other role. But you do it by saying, actually, I'm going to give you this trinket. No, that doesn't happen. Here's what happens instead. And it feels really good in play, like in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah. This is reminding me of like conversation around the X card is often like, hey, it's cool that we all sort of agree formally that if one person doesn't want something to happen, then we're going to like work around that. But like it can be really hard emotionally to use the X card. It can feel transgressive to use the X card and to like get in there and to actually advocate for yourself. And I think that that act of saying no is an act of transgression almost like inherently, especially in like a group setting where like you are the one who is the minority standing against the group. And I think that it's nice to be able to encourage people to feel okay saying stuff, you know?
I think so too. And I think that in Under the Autumn Strangely, which does advocate for use of the X card too, because it's a horror game.
Yeah, of course.
But in that game, it's explicitly like, you know, if you're describing, hey, and then this old lady in this creepy house turns around to her hub and she pulls out this like perfectly baked pie or whatever, then I can be like, no, actually, what she pulls out of the oven is, you know, it's a live cat or whatever, like yeah. some other thing, right, that happens. And the way that it starts to synergize and feel like just regular improv where you're saying yes and
yeah,
is really nice because it is explicitly meant to contradict something that you just said. And I think yeah. this one's fresh in my mind because I played this game pretty recently with a great group of people, but like it starts to feel like, oh, I'm just excited that you played this so that I can mm-hmm. see what you're going to say instead, because clearly you had a different idea than what I did. And I think that that's something that felt really good in a GM-less game, the idea that we could contradict each other instead of always just being like, oh, yeah, oh, that's so great.
Like, if we trust each other, I'm excited mm-hmm. when someone else transgresses because I'm excited to see where they're going to go with it.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that probably pops up in other GM-less games. It just hasn't, in my experience, really mm-hmm. a whole lot, and it definitely hasn't in a mechanized way that yeah. Under the Autumn Strangely presents to you.
Can you think of examples of this feeling of transgressiveness in games that is not attached to the physicality of handing someone a trinket or of cutting up a card or whatever?
Ooh, it's a tough one because I think that there are some games that like blanket statement will be like, if you don't like this, you can change it. But that doesn't feel transgressive to me, right? Because I was already going to change it if I didn't like it.
But I think to me, where I was going to go with this was, I think that everyone feels comfortable doing that. Like, I do Absolutely. Think, like, it's great that you are someone who's like, yeah, I don't like this, so I'm going to change it. But I'm not like that. Like, I do want to see how the game is intended to function, because sometimes you change something and that sometimes there's that meme of a like recipe review that's like, I changed the carrots in this carrot cake to kale and then it was bad. 2 stars. And like, well, maybe you should have used carrots, you know?
Yeah.
And like, sometimes you don't know what the thing is that you're changing. But I think that feeling of, oh, I'm just getting a bad vibe here and I'm just going to do something else, like, that isn't easy for me necessarily.
And I think that that's totally fair. I was a chronic deferential, like, never broke the rules person growing up. And so whenever something is completely in my control, especially in like a solo game, if I don't like it, I'm going to change it or I'm going to put it down and not play it, you know? And and so if the preference is I want to keep playing, I'm just going to change it. But I totally appreciate that that's not something that everybody is comfortable doing, or that's not something that everybody wants to do, because mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of value in wanting to get the experience as close to like what the designer wrote or intended in the game as possible. Example-wise of things that like give you the feeling of transgression, I think there's got to be a game out there that I have played that has like some sort of secret keeping mechanic. I think that that would be a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even playing like Mafia or Werewolf or whatever, just like being a werewolf like feels like I'm getting away with something. Lying is the thing that feels transgressive.
It's lying. It's having a secret. Like, definitely the biggest like transgressive thing that I can think of, like from my own personal gaming experiences, is like the final 5e campaign that my group played, like culminated after years of playing in the same setting. And I played a character that had like a big backstory secret that didn't come out for a long time. And then when it did, it came out in this really explosive way. And so I think that what I would be looking for in like a non-tactile way is games that are encouraging you to have secrets and to make them explosive and maybe not to the benefit of the rest of your peers. Because I think it's a lot easier to make the choice to have something that's like not beneficial to your personal character. But when it's like not beneficial to your fellow player characters, then it becomes something where you're like, oh, is this going to be okay? And so like a game that has that written in, that everyone is aware of that as a possibility. Oh, okay. All right. Curse of House Rookwood does this, where it explicitly is telling you, like, you have secrets. This person might know it. This person is involved in it. And, like, this other person has no idea, but they found this item that they could use to blackmail you if they figured out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so it sets up this really juicy interpersonal web that, to me, feels really, like, key to the game. Like, it would not be the same without it. But it also feels like, is it okay to have these secrets that are like going to screw over the other people? Is it okay if I actually blackmail this other person, you know, because it's not what you normally would want to do, like in the spirit of cooperating or telling a collaborative story in the game, like even about scoundrels, that sometimes feels like, oh no, did I go too far?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. We've gotten very far off course from our buddy Flaros. I sort of have a feeling that this was going to become a little bit of like a survey kind of episode more, but I do want to bring it back to our guy for the kind of send off here. Like, do you have more to say about Flaros himself and how the specificity of the process there sort of plays out for you?
I mean, I know for me personally, in the game that I'm playing of Wreck This Deck, I want to keep like trimming down his card until it's gone. I think that that's really interesting to me. And the idea that like, oh, that would like set him free to do as he pleases. And then he's like an antagonist that I have to deal with or try to trap again somehow, find another three of diamonds that I can trap him in. That might be cool, you know?
Are you like snipping pieces of him off when like major things happen or something?
So if he appears like in the summoning for another demon, I usually like burn the edges down a little bit more.
Interesting.
And then I can't use him for a hex. I don't want to use him for a hex because a hex in this game makes you have to destroy the card. Like that is explicitly you have to. But I've had a couple rituals that like went poorly and he was in one of them. And I was like, ah, man, I'm just going to trim like one side just a little more, and he just keeps getting smaller, and it makes it all the more likely that he'll slip out of my deck when I'm trying to do something else, and we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, interesting. My Flaros,
he killed a bunch of guys for you, right?
I keep like using him to kill a bunch of guys. I just like the triangle of him looks like a dagger to me, and so I like always imagine that I'm stabbing him. You know,
or stabbing with
him. Yeah, I made a guy's head explode. That was fine. I did. It didn't seem like there was a huge difference between hexes and rituals to me. And I was like, nah, I'm just going to do a ritual to make someone's head explode. Does that count as a hex? No, not for me. I'm making his head explode.
Flip to you. Who cares?
Exactly. It's my vibe. So I like this idea, though. This is one of the other demons I like is the Beelzebub. Every time is drawn, you draw another fly onto the card. And then once it gets like fully blackened, the demon escapes from the card or something.
Yes.
I like the idea of, oh, every time I make someone's head explode or whatever, I should just like snip a little bit off of Flaros, like a little bit more off the triangle until just
using until him too much. Yeah, I really love that. I think there's a lot you can do. I made up a demon that is like spreading to other cards, which kind of sucks for me. Like, why did I do that? I don't know. It's fun. Yeah. I love it. But yeah, I have considered being like, should I just glue Flaurus's card to another demon card that I like have already summoned? Like,
oh, that's
he
funny.
Possesses them and takes them over, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Get a little contagion demon going on.
Would be really gross. I would love that.
Okay. Well, do you have any last thoughts on Wreck This Deck or Transgression or Flaros?
Just that I think more people should be open to the possibilities of doing things that feel a little taboo when the game asks you to.
Yeah. Audrey, thanks for being on Dice Exploder.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
Hello, listeners. I am here before the credits because I'm going to try something a little new here after the episode is over and before I sign off for the day. I'm going to give out little homework assignments that are somehow related to the episode. These are going to be like small little design challenges. Maybe you think of them like a game jam that hopefully takes you just a couple of minutes to complete. Do them on your own, post about them online, come talk about them in the Dice Exploder Discord, or simply ignore them. Whatever, I don't care. I hope that they get you thinking about how to take this show and actually put some lessons from it into practice in your own game design work. Anyway, today's prompt is take a game that you don't think of as being a physical game and think about what the physical experience of playing it is like. Like, what is it like to physically roll dice at the table? How does that make you feel? And is there a way you could change that game's physical experience to bring that experience more in line with the game overall thematically? How would you do so? Extra credit for thinking about changing the physical experience of playing a digital game. That's it.
Thanks again to Audrey for being here. You can find her podcast, Alone at the Table, wherever you get your podcasts. And her blog is ladytabletop.wordpress.com. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at S. Dunwald or on the Dice Exploder Discord. You can order my design memoir, Dice Forager, at diceexploder.com, and you can find my games at sdunwald.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And thanks to you for listening. Welcome back. I'll see you next week.